First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Taking steps to protect First Coast teens in the system. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a conversation with State Attorney Melissa Nelson and the Kids Hope Alliance about what they're doing with juvenile diversion programs here in North Florida. Get on the line now. Join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, a look at some good news for your Wednesday. Also, keep it here on 89.9 all through the day and night as we bring you updates from the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network on the path of ELSA through the state. But first this hour, they're fulfilling a commitment they made to the community. The Kids Hope Alliance and the 4th Judicial Circuit State Attorney's Office recently announced the full transfer of juvenile diversion programs from the prosecutor's office to the city's main child welfare agency. Now, this transition was one of a few recommendations made by the Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee. That's a group of community members convened by State Attorney Melissa Nelson several years ago. What will this mean for youth in our area? We're pleased to welcome on the line now State Attorney Melissa Nelson. Good to have you back on the show. Melissa, thanks so much for being with us.
Melissa.
And Katoya Wilkins, Director of Contract Management for the Kids Hope Alliance. Hi, Katoya.
Good morning. How are you?
Great, thanks. Good to have you both on the show. And as we speak with the State Attorney and the Kids Hope Alliance, we want your calls. Yes, there's a storm bearing down, but we've got some other news to get into this hour, so join us. It's 549-2937. Give us a call as we talk about juvenile diversion programs here on the First Coast. 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweets to at Melissa N. Jax, and our Facebook page is open. State Attorney Melissa Nelson, let's begin with you. You created and convened this Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee in 2017. They met for well over a year, issued a final report. So what was the impetus for forming this group, and why did you feel it was important to include all of these community voices in this decision?
Thanks, Melissa. We had hoped that this group of certainly passionate and experienced people in the field of juvenile justice would convene and examine juvenile justice, the continuum of care, and the diversion programming currently in Duval County. Look to best practices and meet and hear from experts across the country outside of our jurisdiction, and then give us, the State Attorney's Office, recommendations for those best practices. Examine what we were doing correctly and give us recommendations on what we could improve. We were really, really impressed with their dedication, their work on this commission, and then ultimately their excellent comprehensive report.
And one of the recommendations from that report that you're now acting on was to transfer diversion programming from the prosecutor's office to the Kids Hope Alliance. Why make this move?
I'm sorry?
Why make this move?
Because the thinking and the research, and I actually agree with this, is that the prosecutor's office, we aren't the most suited to handle diversion programming for youth in the criminal justice system. We are a prosecutor's office, and diversion is actually considered an alternative to the traditional court system. And so it made sense to the commission and their recommendation to us, it made sense to us that diversion be handled actually by those people and those agencies most suited to handle diversion, who have the experience in it, who understand a continuum of care and can provide services in a way that really our prosecutor's office wasn't suited to do.
And can you explain for people who don't follow this what juvenile diversion is all about?
Certainly. So people hear the word diversion or alternative frequently, and maybe some people don't understand what that is. So when someone is arrested, youth or adult, they enter the criminal justice system and they come to our court system, where if our office deems fit to file charges, we initiate a formal prosecution. We really believe that with young kids who are in what we call the shallow end of the system, who have done something that's not that serious. We don't want to put them in that court system. And the research shows us that that actually increases recidivism. That is the likelihood of reoffending and going deeper into the system. So to the extent we can circumvent the regular court system while still holding them accountable, addressing their needs through services, with the goal of hopefully ensuring that they don't reconnect with the criminal justice system. So diversion is programming outside of the traditional court system that focuses on making sure that sanctions are swift and an offender is held accountable, but really services that are geared towards addressing what's giving rise to the criminal behavior.
But this disrupts what is typically known as the school-to-prison pipeline, doesn't it? Once a young person gets into trouble, if they don't get some kind of diversion like what's now being offered, they will just be drawn further and further into the system. They'll have a criminal record. Their future will be cut short.
And so the goal, you're exact, so the goal of diversion for eligible youth is to prevent those consequences.
Yeah.
It's to give another chance. And hopefully, I mean, the goal for everybody, too, is to enhance public safety. We don't want a kid who enters the criminal justice system to continue to reoffend. We want that kid to have hopefully one contact and not be arrested again. And that's one thing we're obviously focused on and watching is it's one thing to stand a system of diversion up. It's another thing to assess if it's working or not. And so we're very early on the transfer to KHA, but that's something we'll be watching over the next couple of years to be able to report the success of the programming as opposed to traditional prosecution in the court system.
If you're just tuning in, it's your chance to connect with State Attorney Melissa Nelson. She's our guest this morning, along with Katoya Wilkins with the Kids Hope Alliance, as we talk about juvenile diversion programs being switched from the prosecutor's office to the KHA. We'll go to your calls in a moment. What are your thoughts about all this? Call us up. It's 549-2937. Katoya Wilkins with the Kids Hope Alliance. Of course, this agency was formed 4 years ago when the Jacksonville Children's Commission and the Jacksonville Journey merged. Can you tell us how that positioned your organization to handle this diversion program and handle juveniles?
Yes. As the city funder for Children's Services, we were one of the only entities that was able to service adequately youth in the city. We are the city's continuum of care for children in Duval County, and we service youth from across the entire spectrum, from early learning, out of school time, which is after school and summer camp programs, to special needs programs, and of course, juvenile justice programs as well. So we are already funding programs such as the Evening Reporting Center, which is an alternative to secure detention. We are also awarded the Criminal Justice Reinvestment Grant, which focuses on providing assessments to youth that are coming through the juvenile justice system. So we provide them with referrals for mental health or substance abuse and things of that nature. So we were prepared to take on this new role.
And tell us about how this will work. This is a whole system of care, as we heard the state attorney mention. Tell us about this system. What happens to a kid if they commit a minor infraction? We've heard a lot about civil citations for juveniles rather than more serious charges so as to protect them, give them more of a chance of a future. That was a big fight that we had in this community a few years ago that we're now seeing we're now seeing civil citations issued to minors more frequently. But tell us more about how this system will work. Take us through the process. Say a young man, steals something from a convenience store or commits some minor infraction like that. What happens next?
Okay, so I'll give you a little breakdown and background on it. So we are really focused on developing a continuum of care. So diversion is no longer just a program, it's actually a system. So if one of the programs stops, the whole system doesn't fall apart. It's a variable of different funding sources. We have a lot of organizations that are functioning as a system and providing services for the youth holistically so they can be successful in a community. So if a youth is arrested, they potentially, they still get the recommendation from the state's attorney's office if they're eligible for diversion. And based on an assessment that is completed, we make recommendations for the youth. So it's individualized case-by-case determination of the services that are offered for the youth. So we are trying to serve them based on their needs and a level of care for the individual. So it's not anything that's prescriptive and that's, you know, just a list of sanctions that are checked off for them to complete. It's an entire evaluation of what's needed for the youth and individual.
Okay, so I know it's hard to that each case is individual, but how does diversion work specifically? Can you, you know, how do you hold a teen accountable without imprisoning them, without slapping serious charges on them? What happens to the teen? What sort of programs do they go through?
So we have a lot of different programs that are in place. So one of the things that we do after we have an evaluation of the youth, it's determine what their needs are. So we utilize the restorative justice model. We work really closely with the Center for Children's Rights. We also provide mental health and substance abuse services as well for the youth. And so it just depends on what the needs are. So we have the services in place for all of the youth. So it's not just, you know, I guess writing a letter of apology or paying restitution and things of that nature. We look at what the needs are for the individual, and we offer the support services in mm-hmm. place for them.
549-2937. So how do you see this impacting teens overall and the city, Katoya? What does this mean for this judicial circuit, in your view?
Well, I'm really excited about it because it provides the opportunity for youth to really be successful. We are working on preventing youth from going deeper into the juvenile justice system and trying to prevent them from going in at all. So I think the services that we are offering here will make a huge impact in the community because over the long term and spectrum, kids will not be involved with the juvenile justice system because they're going to be provided with the services that are needed.
Let's go back to Melissa Nelson, State Attorney Nelson. What is your answer to those who disagree with this change and they would prefer to see a more punitive approach toward teens who offend?
So Melissa, to your earlier question about why convene this group and why ask them to engage in this really labor-intensive curriculum. And it was so that we could get to a place where whatever answer we came to, and obviously this was an enhancement of the diversion system for youth, whatever that answer or recommendation was based on science, research, data collected from other jurisdictions. And so that's what this group did. And so for those who might say, hey, might be skeptical of it or wary of it. We know much about the adolescent brain that we didn't know. Maybe we knew commonsensically from raising kids, but we didn't appreciate the science in the way we do today, even 20 years ago. And so if we accept, you know, the science as true, and we also accept the research that once there is a connection with the criminal justice system, recidivism increases, and what we want to do for public safety is reduce recidivism. We don't want a kid to continue to come in. So the goal of this is actually, the main goal and priority is public safety. The benefits are obviously protecting children from going deeper into the system. And as to the punitive, I would say, you know, this is limited and focused on, when I say eligible youth offenders, minor infractions. What we did do is obviously expand what those offenses look like so that more youth have the availability and potential to take advantage of diversion programming. But these are focused on minor offenses. You know,
right.
You asked about sanctions and what it looks like. I've attended a neighborhood accountability review board through civil citation. And I've watched what happens there. And I'll say, I will say that both in diversion programming and civil citation, which is a pre-arrest diversion, what's different from being in the court system is that the youth has to account, come face-to-face with whatever damage or harm they've caused. They come face-to-face with a victim from whom they've stolen something or from whom they've hurt. And that's different than how our court system functions. And I think actually much more impactful and effective when you're talking about a young person who we want to make sure appreciates the significance of what he or she has done and try to ensure they don't do it again.
Sure. Lots of calls. Let's go to a few. It's 549-2937. Your chance to connect with State Attorney Melissa Nelson and also Katoya Wilkins with the Kids Hope Alliance. 549-2937. Susan in Mandarin. Hi, Susan. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I just was so glad for the second half. I heard the first half, the first mention of restorative justice. And I'm so glad she went further to say how impactful it is to the students. I was just wondering, is there a place for volunteers to be able to assist with that process with the kids?
Oh, thanks for that. Katoya Wilkins, Kids Hope Alliance. Let's talk about restorative justice as a concept and also how people who want to volunteer can.
Yes. So restorative justice kind of focuses on the youth taking responsibility for the actions that they had at hand and giving the victim an opportunity to have a voice as well. So that's the model that we actually use and focus on. We also work with resiliency navigators in the program to help the youth be successful in a program. And that's a great question pertaining to the volunteers. The provider that we work with that is running a diversion system is the Partnership for Child Health. I will definitely work with them directly to see if there's opportunities for the community to get involved and offer services as well, and we'll make sure it's on our website.
That's great. The Kids Hope Alliance is the place to go, Susan. Melissa Nelson, you know, when you became state attorney some years back, you campaigned on a new approach for this office, a less punitive approach, a more of a smart justice, restorative justice approach. Several years into the position, as you look at your leadership, how do you feel about the change? And what's the feedback you get from the community about the change?
We continue to get positive feedback from the community. One of the things that we're interested in, I think I mentioned earlier, is measuring the effectiveness of anything we're doing. So any new initiative or program that we have rolled out, we, one, first try to build consensus and bring every stakeholder together to think through potential issues before we launch something. And then on the back end, we try to really stay vigilant on measuring the success and reporting that publicly through our website to the public on how we're doing. So our feedback has continued to be good. We're using and relying on experts in fields beyond ourselves. We know, obviously, how to investigate and prosecute cases in the criminal courts, but we also know, because of mental health issues, substance abuse issues, issues with youth in the criminal justice system, there are alternatives that are more effective than the traditional system. Mm-hmm. And so if we can avail ourselves as a community and as an office to those alternatives, it ends up saving tax dollars. And hopefully the goal is making everybody safer, because we don't want people, like I've said again over and again, if they enter our system, we would like for them not to come back. And so we are using our problem-solving courts at a higher degree than we have in the past. We're using alternatives and diversion programming at a higher degree than we have in the past. We've created a position, a smart justice coordinator, who's overseeing these efforts for our office and training our lawyers and staff about what diversion is and what problem-solving courts are. And so I think the shift in thinking and the engagement with these programs at a higher level hopefully benefits all of us.
While we have you, before we say goodbye, let me ask you about a broader question. Overall crime is down across the state, but violent crimes actually ticked up. Duval County had 143 murders in 2020. That's the highest number of homicides per capita of any Florida county. So gun violence and homicide continues to be a problem here. That includes some juveniles who have been shot.
Yes.
So as state attorney, how do you work with law enforcement on this issue? And what are your thoughts about the White House's recent approach to combating gun violence?
So let me take the first part of your question first. Gun violence and reducing violent crime and thinking about how we at the state attorney's office can use our tools to contribute to a violence reduction strategy has been, of everything we've done, my top priority. So I, as much as I am focused and appreciate alternatives to the court system, I have also recognized and been very focused on how we can advance public safety for serious offenders. You know, today's discussion is about insignificant lower offenses with young people, not gun violence. So right now, today, knock on wood, what we're seeing mid-year here in 2021 is a decrease in both murders and bullet-to-flesh shootings in Jacksonville. I don't know if that will hold for the rest of the year. I'm hopeful that maybe it is a result of some of the investments we've been making in partnership with the city and law enforcement over the last couple of years, which have included, obviously, the establishment of the Crime Gun Intelligence Center, the use of NIBIN, the weekly meetings with our law enforcement partners on what is happening on our streets, the utilization of interventions in addition to enforcement. So I'm hopeful by this year's numbers. I'll say that last year, what we saw here in Jacksonville, we saw across the country. And I think for reasons that, you know, criminologists will be studying for years to come about why, what we are seeing in Jacksonville different today than what we're seeing across the country is what was the aberration last year and the increase in violence across the country is continuing in major cities.
Yeah.
And we are actually now seeing a decrease. It's too early to celebrate any of that yet, Melissa, but it is, it's certainly worth noting.
That's a hopeful sign, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The White House's pledge, I'm very excited about their commitment to focus on local communities and gun violence. I was on a call maybe a month ago where they laid out their priorities, which are going to obviously inform their grant making as well. And I hope our city and certainly our office will be in good position because of some of the things we have already done to take advantage of when those are announced. Some federal grant in the future.
We will follow that. And I want to thank you both, State Attorney Melissa Nelson and Katoya Wilkins, Director of Contract Management with the Kids Hope Alliance. Ladies, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Much more still ahead. Later in the hour, some good news for your midweek and our What's Good Wednesdays, and a lot of sports news. Our own Josh Torres will bring us up to date, but up next.
Really, I began my career in real estate, really the age of 11, when my mother first achieved her real estate license, and she was a single mother of two young girls.
The Jacksonville mother and daughter who have reached the pinnacle of the real estate world. That's next. Well, there are two powerhouse female executives here on the First Coast who just happen to be mother and daughter. This month, local real estate executive Christy Budnick got a huge promotion. Budnick has now been named the global network CEO for Berkshire Hathaway. That's the real estate giant. She had a strong role model growing up. Her mother, Linda Shearer, is founder and chairman of Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Florida Network Realty. I spoke with mom and daughter about their success. Take a listen. Christy, Linda, thanks for being with us. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to you, too.
And I want to extend a hearty congratulations to you both on your success in the real estate world and blazing new paths for female executive leadership here on the First Coast. Christy, let's begin with you. Kudos on the new role. Tell us about how you got here and what your plans are for the next 6 months.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate that. So really, I began my career in real estate at the age of 11 when my mother first achieved her real estate license. And she was a single mother of two young girls. And so my sister and I truly were her marketing department. We were, you know, walking flyers in neighborhoods, helping her with open houses. It was really a very much a family business. So fast forward to several years later, she had the opportunity to open what was then Prudential Network Realty. And that was, I mean, talk about a trailblazing moment to be a woman in, you know, and president and CEO. It was just such an incredible opportunity and one that she didn't blink. She immediately jumped on. She said if she had known more at the time, she might not have necessarily made that leap. But I'm so grateful that she did. And so about 19 years ago, after a successful career in consumer finance with a series of banks that, you know, purchased one another, I was working with Bank of America as the head of sales and leadership training for the nation. And I really enjoying it, but I was ready for a change. And so Linda and I came together and started talking about it. And we both decided that that was a good time for me to join the family, the company.
Absolutely. Wow. Linda, as Christy's mom, you must be so proud. And it's really exciting to see how you modeled leadership and really became one of the highest ranking female executives in Jacksonville way before it was common. And so Christy had a really nice role model to pattern herself after. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you're being very kind, Melissa, and I appreciate that very much, and we're glad to be here today. But, you know, necessity really makes you get your act together and go in a direction that you thought you never could be. And I had so many good people that, you know, wished me well and worked with me, particularly the Petway family, and just could not have been better as far as establishing the company back in 1988. And so, yes, Christy saw a great work ethic in her mother.
Yes.
And it was because I have such a passion for real estate. And it's really been a remarkable ride. And to your first comment about Christy, I don't think anything could be as gratifying to a parent than to see their child succeed and then have it acknowledged by a promotion like this. And she is very decisive. She is very smart. And a really great talent is that she's very compassionate. And it's hard to get all those different disciplines at the same time. And she manages that beautifully. And I really think that that's why she was chosen for this extraordinary role.
And I'm sure you have a lot of exciting things on your plate, Christy. Let me ask you about how you plan to mentor other women, because real estate has been good to women. It's an area where women really can rise to these roles, which you both have done, which we don't always see in other corporations. So how do you see that? How do you see mentoring other women who will be inspired by your success?
Oh, thank you, Melissa. So a couple of things. First, I'd kind of like to go back and share that, you know, my sister and I, we didn't know any boundaries because we had a mom who was so well respected in the business world And I don't think it was until we were a little bit older that we realized just how unusual that was. I mean, we kind of knew that growing up, but we didn't realize the impact that she had made in the business world fully, I think, until we were probably in our 20s. And the fact that she raised us believing that we could achieve or do anything, there was absolutely nothing that was off the table. And we saw it firsthand with her. So we were very fortunate to benefit from having a mother in that role and such a strong role model. The way that I personally like to mentor other women and just really truly people as a whole is, you know, I think as a leader, you have an ability to see talent in others where they don't necessarily see it themselves most of the time. And when you see that talent as a leader, you have a responsibility to help that person grow and become their very best. And over the years, that's one of the things that Linda and I have taken very, very seriously with both women and just people in general in our company. Talent, we start giving tasks or projects or leadership opportunities to that individual and help them grow and recognize their potential. And there's one person that really resonates with me that she was a very shy, she definitely did not see herself as a leader at all. She would always ask permission for everything. And I remember sitting down with her and challenging her. And I said, I dare you to make a mistake. And she looked at me, she was shocked that I said that. And I said, because when you make mistakes, it shows that you are really reaching and trying and getting out of your comfort zone. And so she took that to heart and she really began just flourishing. It was so much fun to see. And now that person actually leads one of our departments in the company. And she is such a strong and, again, decisive leader. It's been so much fun to watch her grow.
That's great. Now, let me ask you, Linda, about the real estate market right now. It's going crazy. Low inventory, high demand. what's that like for you? And what advice do you have for people looking to buy or sell?
Oh, yes. Well, we certainly have advice. And I would like to back up, though, and just say that it's not that we don't have inventory. We have low standing inventory is the difference, because pending sales are up 25% in the MLS and closed sales are up over 25%. So there are sales that are taking place. Everyone has to be patient when they're going through that process and be prepared, which speaks to your question. You know, the things that we've always done would be have you pre-qualified, pre-approved. A cash offer certainly gets attention. You know, just making sure that you know what the seller really wants. Is it a closing date that's soon? Is it a closing date that's pushed out and they want to lease back? Find out those particulars. But the most important thing you can do is to hire a very sharp realtor, because they will be able to put that transaction for you. And trying to do it on your own would be really challenging in this market and in any market, really, but particularly this one.
Yeah. And I would also echo that right now, one of the things that has always been so satisfying for realtors is the buyer finds their home, they fall absolutely in love with it, they negotiate the contract, and they're able to achieve success with that home that they fell in love with. But right now, we're having to tell people, don't fall completely in love with it, because there is a chance that, a pretty good chance, that you may not get this home, you know, unless you're the highest offer that comes in or you hit all of those sellers' hot buttons. So, you know, we're seeing, you know, buyers that are having to make 4 and 5 offers on homes before they're able to secure one. And that's really kind of heartbreaking. It makes it difficult, certainly for the buyers, but also for the realtors.
I can only imagine. Well, I know you're both very busy with everything that's going on in your business right now. So get after it, as I know you will. And congratulations to Christy Budnick, the new Global Network CEO for Berkshire Hathaway Home Services. And, of course, she learned from her mother, Linda Scherer, a leader in real estate for many years here on the First Coast. Ladies, congratulations to both of you. Thanks.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you for having us, Melissa.
Well, it's been a busy few weeks in the wide world of sports, both here in Jacksonville and beyond. Our director, Josh Torres, is here now with an update, beginning with the NCAA paying athletes, Josh. That's huge.
Yes, it is, Melissa. This is kind of coming after the NCAA had a Supreme Court case go through where they actually lost pertaining to antitrust laws with... So now that also a lot of states are starting to pass laws essentially saying that athletes should be allowed to get paid for their likeness, which a lot of people have been arguing for many years. Well, after seven states passed laws that were going to go into effect on the first of this month, the NCAA said, you know what, let's just go ahead and get rid of our rules. And they're kind of hoping eventually Congress steps in and sets more stricter rules, but just kind of a better set of rules. Because right now the rules are very broad and are either set by the states themselves or they're kind of up to the schools. But almost as soon as the new rules went into effect last Thursday night, everybody started signing new deals. In fact, the son of rapper Master P, Hersey Miller, signed a $2 million deal with a web app company. And the best part is he hasn't even started college yet. He will begin his college career this year, but he is going to be stepping onto campus as a millionaire.
Jeez, this is just a whole new world. I mean, as you said, though, these athletes have made so much money for colleges for so long. I think this had been called for a long time. Now, speaking of big paychecks, let's talk about Trevor Lawrence and his new deal with the Jaguars.
Yes, he finally has signed his rookie deal. It is a four-year deal for $36.8 million with 24.1 of that guaranteed, and the team did add a fifth-year team option. So if he is the star that we're all praying that he is going to be, the team has the option to pick him up for a fifth year on that deal before signing him to an extension. And I think his new head coach, Urban Meyer, might need to be asking for a little tip on the way because him as well as the team have just been fined by the NFL this past week for violations during their off-season training program. The team itself was fined $200,000 while Urban Meyer was fined for $100,000. And it had to do with contact violations. The current rules are that during these off-season training programs, there's absolutely no contact allowed during any of their drills. And apparently they kind of looked the other way for Urban Meyer's staff did while they were doing that. So the team has been fined. He's been fined as well. And the team will also lose two of their OTA practices for next year.
Kind of gives you an idea of how Urban might be managing the team in the early going, though.
Just a little bit, yeah. There have been some kind of whispers of, okay, Urban, what you doing here, man? Like, we really can't be having this, and you haven't even actually stepped on the field as an NFL coach yet.
And speaking of that, training camp for the Jaguars is coming up, gosh, right around the corner.
Yep, end of this month, on July 27th, is when we will begin training camp for the Jags. As they gear up for their first preseason game on August 14th, when they'll take on the Cleveland Browns, and we'll finally get to see Urban Meyer on the field, and Trevor Lawrence will be on the field as well. We'll get to see what the future of the team's going to look like, which also quickly I would like to go ahead and plug that if you happen to be, we do offer parking over at WJCT Studios. So,
that's right.
If you happen to need a parking space for going to a game, come and visit us. We're right across from the stadium.
That's right. WJCT.org/parking. We have season ticket holders who've been parking in our lot for Jaguars games for years.
Yes, they have.
And it's always fun to see them. Okay, let's talk about the Icemen. They've switched their affiliation to the New York Rangers.
Yes, they have. The team as they're entering their fifth season of play. It's kind of hard to believe they've already been around for 5 years. But they had spent the past four seasons as the affiliate of the Winnipeg Jets. They are now switching to the New York Rangers as well as the Hartford Wolfpack, who are the AHL affiliate of the Rangers. For those of you who don't know, the Icemen play in the ECHL, which is, to put it in easier terms, is the double A of the ice hockey hierarchy. And also this year, the Icemen will be hosting the ECHL All-Star Game. They were actually supposed to host it back in 2019, and the coronavirus kind of put a damper on things. It was 2020 they were supposed to host it this past year. And yeah, it put a little damper on that. But the Icemen have a very strong fan base. We've ranked number three this past year, even despite the pandemic.
Okay. And keeping it in the same sport, could Tampa actually win back-to-back Stanley Cups?
Ooh, that is a tough question. Yeah, they're up 3-1 right now in the Stanley Cup final against Montreal. They did lose on Monday night to the Canadiens in overtime with a goal from Josh Anderson. And Game 5 is still going to be tonight, despite Tropical Storm Elsa coming through. And Montreal's going to have to win in Tampa twice before they even have a chance to lift the cup. They're going to have to win it tonight in Tampa, go back up to Montreal to win it again, and then win one more time in Tampa. And in all honesty, I don't see that happening. Tampa is, in my honest opinion, the stronger team.
That would be so exciting. All right, let's talk about the Summer Olympics, because a number of local athletes are going to the big games in Tokyo. This is really cool.
Yes, it is. The Tokyo Olympics are still expected to begin later this month, and we do have quite a few athletes who will be joining the USA teams. Garrett Scantling, who graduated from Episcopal, will be on the track and field team. We also have Clay High graduate Caleb Dressel and Bowles graduate Ryan Murphy, who will both be on the swimming team. Mandarin grad Michelle Moultrie, who will be on the softball team, and Kelly O'Hara, who is from she was born in Jacksonville. She does consider Fayetteville, Georgia, as her hometown, but she still was born here in Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. Will be competing on the U.S. Women's National Team in soccer.
And even a player with the Jacksonville Shrimp, infielder Eddie Alvarez, he's been named to the U.S.
baseball team roster.
So we're getting a nice showing at the Tokyo Olympics. Really cool. Okay, last but not least, the Jax Sharks.
Yes, they are trying to defend their 2019 title. They won the title in 2019, but of course their 2020 season was canceled due to the pandemic. So they are officially on the road to defending that, and the road has started off very, very rocky for the Sharks. They are 1-3 with 2 losses to the Orlando Predators, surprisingly by the same exact score in both games, 52-41, as well as a loss to the Columbus Lions, 56-32. They did win a game against the Albany Empire, 61-58, but so far their road to another championship has not started off very well.
Hopefully they can come back, and always good to get your insights from a really busy sports picture here on the First Coast. Exciting to see that. Thank you so much, Josh.
Absolutely, Melissa.
In a moment, a look at what's good this Wednesday, including 2 new shows on stage this summer at the Five and Dime Theater. That's next.
Announcing Vickers Landing at Oak Bridge, bridging retirees with an all-new Ponte Vedra Beach community featuring new homes, a resort lifestyle, and a life plan for every stage of aging. Information at VickersLanding.com.
Congaree and Penn,
dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpenn.com.
I'm Jane Clayson. Black blues musician Daryl Davis has spent years fighting racism after bonding with a KKK member over music at a bar.
The fact that a Klansman and a black person could sit down at the same table, enjoy the same music, that was a seed planted.
How Davis sees white supremacy today, next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, a turning point in the fight for women's reproductive rights. The 1873 Comstock Act virtually outlawed contraception. We'll talk about the man behind the law, anti-vice crusader Anthony Comstock, and the women prosecuted under that statute. They're the subject of a new book by Amy Sohn, who will be our guest. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
He's best known as an on-screen baddie, one shot, stabbed, hanged, chopped up, and crushed by an elevator. But off-screen, Danny Trejo has battled drugs and stints in some of the country's most notorious state prisons. He lays out his role from solitary to the big screen and beyond in his new memoir. Danny Trejo was one of our guests, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Two new shows are on stage this summer at the Five and Dime Theater. I got a preview from their managing artistic director, Bradley Akers. Hey, Bradley, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you, Melissa.
So lots happening at the Five and Dime this summer. Tell us what's on the table.
That's right. Well, we are celebrating our 10th year this year. September 24th, 2011 was our first production as a theater company. And we have returned to our nomadic roots, just like we were in that first couple of years. And we are bringing a one-man show called August Wilson's How I Learned What I Learned to the community. And that is, August Wilson is affectionately known as theater's poet of Black America. And he wrote a groundbreaking series of 10 plays known as the American Century Cycle, which chronicles the experiences and heritage of the African-American community in the 20th century. So it was one play per decade. Now, August wrote something that a lot of people don't know of, and instead of just writing an autobiography in book form, he said, I'm going to do it as a one-man show. And so he wrote this play. It chronicles his life as a Black artist in America through struggling and his journey of self-discovery through adversity and what it means to be a Black artist in America. And so we're thrilled that that's going to be the very first production back after a long year of no theater and really trying to navigate through these times.
Yeah. So the first in-person show, will it be a packed show or will you distance the seats?
That's right. So we are going to distance the seats. We are performing at the Garden Club of Jacksonville in Brooklyn. And so what's really nice about that space is it's a very big ballroom. So we're able to really space people out so that they still feel like they're getting the same experience that they may be used to, but in as safe as possible as we can.
Yeah. And so that's coming up July 16th through the 18th. And then in August, you've got the Short Attention Span Festival. What's that all about?
That's right. So the Short Attention Span Theater Festival started in 2019. We had one planned for 2020, but we had to postpone it. And this year we're doing a two-day theater festival that celebrates short, original, new plays from voices all across the city. So live in-person plays, 5 to 10 minutes, never seen before, will take the festival. And then we're combining them with what we call the very shorts, which are 1 to 5 minute virtual live-to-tape plays. So we're trying to navigate through bringing real, new, original short plays in creative ways that still speaks to how do we navigate this journey of returning to in-person as safe as possible. So we're really excited to celebrate and emphasize Jacksonville as the vibrant performing arts city that it is, and uplift voices. And that's really our vision moving forward, is how do we uplift the artistic voice in Jacksonville?
Check it all out online at thefiveanddime.org and get your tickets for both of these productions. Bradley Akers with the Five and Dime Theater, thanks so much and have fun.
Thank you, Melissa.
And despite that tropical storm bearing down on us, we've got some more positive news to share right now. It's our What's Good Wednesdays. Speaking of live theater, in St. Augustine, Apex Theater Studio will continue its summer season with the musical adaptation of Little Women. It's set for this Friday and Saturday night at Lewis Auditorium on the campus of Flagler College in St. Augustine. The Summer at the Cummer series, presented by PNC Bank, is back at the Cummer Museum, and it runs through September 3rd. What this means is free admission during extended hours, 4 o'clock to 9 p.m. every Friday night. Check it out. They have live music, art, experiences, lawn games, and more, and it's all free at the Cummer on Friday nights. A big congrats to Edward Waters College. They are now Edward Waters University, following a new accreditation. The Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges has upgraded EWU to allow them to have master's degree programs. Edward Waters first opened in 1865, Florida's first historically black college and the state's oldest independent institution of higher learning. EWU will begin offering its first master's degree program, an online MBA program, beginning this fall. Applications are open now. Well, have you been to a ball game this summer? The Jumbo Shrimp are always a fun night out for the family. And as we mentioned a few minutes ago on the show, USA Baseball has announced the team's infielder, Eddie Alvarez, has been named to the U.S. baseball team roster for the 2021 Summer Olympics in Tokyo. Alvarez is a heck of an athlete. He looks to become just the third American to medal in both the Winter and Summer Olympics. He actually earned a silver medal in speed skating during the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi. Really exciting. And so as we track good news across this community and talk about it every Wednesday on the show, we want to hear from you. If you have an item you'd like us to add to our weekly menu, send us an email. And we might also put it in our weekly What's Good Wednesday newsletter, which goes out later today. And that's our show. Thanks for listening. And thanks to producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, editorial director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. Now, as we've been talking about, Tropical Storm Elsa is headed our way. We are going to get some wind and rain. Keep it right here on 89.9 as we bring you regular updates from the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Remember, all through hurricane season, if all power goes out, you can always listen to the radio. We will always be on and we will always be plugged in to the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network, your mainstay during storm season. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay safe, everyone.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.